This week's guest is bassist, composer, and instructor John Ferrara. John is an exceptional bassist known for his distinctive playing style and fusion of genres. In the episode, he shares that he was encouraged into bass playing by his musical family, but explains that years later he'd actually stopped playing to pursue other options. That was until his contributions to the band Consider the Source had changed the trajectory of his whole career. So how did you first get into playing bass? What drew you to the instrument? I always ask people this. It's always my first question because I love to know kind of like why and how everything happened.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I grew up in a musical household. My dad's a guitarist, mm-hmm. and that's what he does, you know, for work as well. And he always wanted both of his kids. I have a brother too, and he wanted us to be able to play so he could play with us. And, you know, how awesome and meaningful would that be? But yeah. I went in kicking and screaming. I was not interested at first. I played piano when I was 4. He had me do that. And he was like sitting me
so
there.
So difficult piano is.
So difficult. And not only just the playing of it, but with my tiny little fingers, but also reading. I'm still, to this day, I'm a terrible reader. And I really, really hated that part of it. And so he was sitting me down trying to get me to learn these things, and I was just not having it. And then I didn't have any interest in playing music again until I was about 13. And he had kept on asking me throughout the years if I would play bass, if I would give it a try. And I was like, no, I'm okay. I was doing art. I was more into drawing and stuff. And then, one day he wrote me in by saying he would teach me Hey Joe by Jimi Hendrix. Because he was a massive Hendrix fan. And he sat me down and I started playing it, and immediately I was in love. I was like, oh my God, I could do this. I can like play this bass line that I've heard 1,000 times and like be part of the music, part of, you know, like imagine I'm like in the band and like playing with them. That's so cool. And it was like right away, I was learning all the bass lines, all this music that I was into at the time. And then shortly after that, a friend of the family who was also a bass player made me a slap bass mixtape. And it had like Victor Wooten, and it had Marcus Miller, Jonas Hellborg, a bunch of other people that I don't think I ever learned the names of. And I started falling in love with some of the more like left to center bass players right out the gate. Like within a month of playing, I was introduced to these players. And then I got into Primus, like anyone, you know, my age at the time, if you were a bass player, you loved Primus. And I was obsessed. I started practicing. I started playing, diving really into it. And then my dad, being, you know, awesome and supportive and really excited that I was taking to it, started getting me gigs playing with him in his projects. And he was like, he's like, you know, a brilliant musician and would always get hired to be sort of the musical director for different projects. And so I'm like this 15-year-old kid who has no business being there. You know, like I had chops and whatever. I had like, you know, I could do like the fancy stuff, but I didn't know who I was as a player or anything like that. But he kind of just brought me into these bands and had me play with people that were way better than me. And like, they would say one thing, you know, about me rushing or about, you know, holding out certain notes longer, little things like that. And I would really take to them because I didn't want to be, you know, I wanted to hold my own next to these players.
Yeah.
So between my dad and all these other people that were very patient with me and just really cool and monster players, I really learned the professional side of music,
uh-huh. you
know, how to be a professional, how to really like do your homework and come to the gig prepared. And so I'm really thankful for that. You know, even though it was music that wasn't really like what I wanted to necessarily be doing all the time, I learned a ton, and it forced me to have to learn a lot of music. So I developed my ear, and like countless other things that I learned that I can't even trace back to it that I'm sure started there.
That's crazy. So you were like thrown into the deep end pretty much from the start. That's
right
so
out the gate.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is insane. Do you think if you weren't thrown into the deep end that your journey would have been, I don't want to say slower, but it definitely would have been different if your dad hadn't taken you to these gigs and...
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, both my parents are very supportive and nurturing of that side. you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are in general. They're lovely people. My mom is she directs community theater plays. So I grew up.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I grew up going to plays every summer and like spending them pretty much there with her and, you know, watching the band rehearse and mm-hmm. watching everyone like, you know, go over their parts and just be creative in whatever realm, the people making the costumes, the people making the set, the actors, everything. And then it got to a point where me and the original drummer from my main project, Consider the Source, we grew up together, and he's, you know, a great drummer, and we started just doing all those plays together. So, so that was like another part of like my musical upbringing was not just playing with my dad, but also doing all these plays where like, you know, I didn't love all of them, but you know, you still learn a ton sitting in the pit in any play, really. You know, you have to be really focused, really patient. You might have to sit out for like 5 or 10 minutes and then come right in. So, you know, I really had a very great upbringing when it came to nurturing my creative side. I'm very fortunate for that.
That's crazy. I've had a lot of people's, I call them origin stories, like they're flipping superheroes, but you kind of are really. But I've heard a lot of them and I think you, you really are though. I'm not even like saying that, but you are. I've heard a lot of them, and I think yours is incredibly cool. And I love that you have parents involved in the arts. I actually was into theatre for a long, long time. Theatre before music. I studied performing arts for 2 years, and then when COVID hit, I kind of realised that the performing arts, it just wasn't for me, just because I saw how competitive it was. And again, I mean, I've mentioned my introversion, but I'm also incredibly anxious too. So the thought of like competing with other people and doing all the auditions, I think I let that get to me a little bit, which I don't know, maybe I regret a little, but I've ended up here and I couldn't be any more grateful for it. I picked up bass playing in lockdown. And it's changed my life. So I also love that your mom's involved in that. That's really cool.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and you know, I think there's something cool about like you just said, like you wonder if maybe, you know, you wish it went different or you did something different. Well, you know, we can't always know. And we have to be where we're at during those times. And now look at you. You know, you're doing great with bass. You have a successful page and you know, it seems like it's thriving. So it's all about like the meaning we derive from things, what we do with them after the fact. But also, one thing that I love about the music world, out of all the arts, I feel like there's room for everybody, you know, whereas, you know, like I think with acting, you know, there's all these stories about people being more cutthroat. And it being more competitive, like really it obviously
was crazy.
I've seen it backstage a little bit, but I can only imagine like actually being part of it, what it, the stress it would put on. I'm very happy that I'm a musician where like I can do the weird stuff that I do. And, you know, aside from a couple of the trolling comments every now and then, which is going to happen. And
inevitable, really. Yeah,
it is. At this point, I think of Stewie Griffin. I'm like, your anguish sustains me. But yeah, it's really cool that we have enough room, you know, in this subculture, whatever, to you know, be who we are. And if we just keep doing the thing that we do, we find our audience. They'll gravitate towards us. And as long as you're doing it well and you're doing it honestly and you know, you keep on doing it, I really feel like that's a pretty cool trajectory.
No, I completely agree, actually. And it's nice to hear you say it because I've not worked in the music industry really for very long at all, been a part of the industry for very long at all. But a part of me was like, well, if the acting industry I thought was competitive, then what about the music one? But hearing you say that, and I do agree from my experience, like there is space for everyone. You can be yourself a lot more. Like those 2 years I studied performing arts, it was so mentally draining competing with everyone, not feeling like you're good enough. And yeah, that just, I don't think I cried as much in those 2 years I have in my whole life. It was hard. It is a lot. I respect people who are able to do it. I really do. And that's not to say that the music industry isn't hard and there's not competitive moments in there. I spoke to someone actually who, I think he studied classical violin, and he spoke a lot about that, about competitiveness in like those kind of classical environments. It's crazy.
Yeah, I guess
I can understand. I can imagine that too.
Totally. And that, and I guess, yeah, that's a different part of the musical world that I guess I can make the statement I just made, because I'm not in the academic world really.
Uh-huh.
You know, not like the formally academic world like that. So, but yes, there is that in the classical world. There's even that a little bit in, like, you know, I guess any major music school, you know.
You can say that anywhere.
And even if it's not overt, you know, you have like, you're constantly around other people who are, you know, like I have a couple of students that go to Berkeley, and, you know, I've observed over the years just people who will go in and come out just super stressed or jaded, you know, and I'm not saying anything about Berkeley as an entity, but it's just a trajectory that people sometimes, they feel pressure, they feel competition.
Mm-hmm.
And where there, some competition is really good for us and could, you know, push us along. When you have that much money sunk into it and that much looming debt, you know, that's much extra pressure and all this stuff on top of the just pressure you have of wanting to become a great player and wanting to get gigs and make that your living and everything. So, I wish that the whole narrative around all of it could change somehow, you know, and people could go back to a time where they're doing it for a different reason, you know, and myself included, you know. I think it's just wrapped up. It's embedded in our culture to thrive and be ambitious and all that. And, where there is a place for it, I feel like we put aside the artistic, really natural, really human side of it, of just wanting and needing to express our life, you know, what our lives are and what happens in it and who we are. That gets put to the side for all this other stuff, and we get stressed. Crazy.
Yeah, you're so right, and that's such a great point. Like you said, not calling out Berkeley as, you know, a thing in itself, but I think with those institutions, it is really hard and unavoidable for people to not be stressed and not lose their kind of musical expression, because like you audition to get into these places, and then like you said, you've got the financial stresses on top of it, and then the people that you're surrounded by. I think it's not just a Berkeley thing, it's when you're educated in those environments, that it's just unavoidable.
Absolutely.
Having that stress and competition. So did you not go to a music institution at any point?
I didn't. You know, I guess to kind of continue the origin story. I pretty much just jumped band to band. You know, my whole teenage years after that, you know, while playing with my dad, playing with my drummer, Justin, my buddy. And we were in a bunch of different projects together. You know, any side gigs, you know, if I was getting hired, he would get hired, that sort of thing. So I'm just playing, gigging all the time, and just exploring the instrument. And if I was into slap bass, I would dive into it and try all sorts of stuff. I got into odd time signatures, dive into that, got into Indian music, dove into that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Consider the Source started, you know, it took a bunch of years for us to really start, you know, gaining any kind of momentum. But between, at that point I was teaching lessons. And between that and the little bit amount of pay that we were getting from our gigs, I was able to sort of just sustain a career doing music between teaching and performing. And actually, I skipped one big part. I did stop playing for about a year and a half before Consider the Source started. And it's because I... you know, kind of like what we were saying a couple of minutes ago, music became something else for me. It was completely wrapped up in my ego and completely wrapped up in, like, I am only as good a human as I am on bass, and I'm only as good as the praise I get, you know? And, that was very, unhealthy, very uncomfortable feeling to, latch onto that. And it was completely the total opposite of what music is supposed to be, or any art is supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know? So I was kind of burnt out, and I wasn't happy playing, and I wasn't happy in any of the projects that I was in at the time. This is, you know, prior to Consider the Source starting. And so I, in college, instead of studying music, I studied psychology and philosophy, and I was just going to do that. I was going to become a therapist, and I was going to just do music as a hobby and relate to it, you know, in a different way. And I was pretty set on that for a couple of years. And then Consider the Source started in the middle of all that.
Mm.
And we started gigging, and I started being able to, all the techniques that I was developing that didn't have a place in any of the gigs that I was getting, all of a sudden they could flourish and they can really become something. And, I could dive deeper and deeper into them, with no holdbacks. You know, it was just, we were all just doing our own thing. We all have our own things that we like to explore, and let's just see where this project can go with all of us having our own voice and, you know, no holds barred kind of mentality when it came to just doing what you wanted to do. And that's all I wanted out of music. I didn't want to do the for hire thing anymore. I didn't want to do cover gigs. It just wasn't what my interest was. So when that, you know, when the band started and I was able to, you know, explore these things more, I was like, all right, you know, I'm not doing psych anymore. I know, I'll finish my degree just to...
No therapist for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Saving people one at a time? Nah.
No.
I'm gonna do music for me.
Well, you can still save people doing that. I'm sure you have. I'm sure there's so many people who are thankful for the music that you've made. So you could say you had a wider reach. I mean, you wouldn't know, but as a musician, then... an alternative career as a therapist.
It is a beautiful thing that, you know, we could kind of do what is meaningful to us, and it does inspire other people for the people that it does. So, yeah, very, very fortunate.
I think it's so cool that you were able to say that I took a year and a half off of playing and you didn't know if you would ever do it again. That's just... so cool of you to be so open about. I think that would help a lot of people hearing that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's it was a tough time, you know. It was a tough decision to make, and it was scary, and it was a totally new territory. And for up at that point, you know, I guess I was like 20 when, or 19 or 20, and so I'd been playing for 6 or 7 years at that point, and but it was everything to me. So I was really bummed out, you know, in order to make that kind of decision. I was really just not happy with it. But I think that the overarching lesson was, you know, you have to listen to the messages, you know, like if your body's telling you something, if you're constantly stressed, then there's something that has to give. There's something that has to change. Something's not working. And it might be something within, you know, it might be like how you're relating to yourself. It might be something about the circumstances you're in, but you have to do that investigation in order to grow the way you're supposed to grow. And so I definitely learned that from it as the years went on and really reflecting on it. And I'm so thankful that I did take the time, because I almost broke. You know, I was bending, and it was almost to the point where I was like, no way am I ever doing music again. It's tainted forever, you know. But it didn't get to that point. It was just I needed to recalibrate.
Yeah, and without doing that, you don't know, you probably... could have got to a position where you gave it up forever. Who knows? I think it's a really great message, and I couldn't agree more of kind of listening to your body, your head, and what you need to do. Like you said, sometimes it is something that you just need to work through personally. So you might not be at the position where you need to take a year and a half off. You might just be in a position where you need to switch your mindset and work harder on different things. But I know, I completely agree. I think that's... people are going to really appreciate hearing that. So I know you mentioned that you aren't into reading music and still now aren't, I think you said you weren't the best at it. What's theory been like for you then? Because I from your story, I assume that it wasn't something that you focused on in the beginning.
Yeah, certainly not in the beginning, but as probably a lot of people know who will listen to this, you will reach a plateau, and then you're going to be really frustrated, and then you're going to have to start from scratch in some area of music where you're not used to starting from scratch, because now you've developed some technique and you've learned a bunch of songs and maybe you've written your own bass lines. So it's very frustrating to you know, have to feel like you're starting from scratch somewhere. So what I do is, I know a lot about theory, and I have utilized it, and I'm not, like, as I said, academically trained, so there's a lot that I'm missing. But what I do, especially with my students, and this is what worked with me, so I teach it, is I at least the very bare minimum go over the modes and the arpeggios that belong to them, which means the chords that belong to them, because they're really the building blocks of Western music. So regardless of what genre you're in, you'll get immense benefits to be taken from that one concept. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, because if you learn the scales and then you learn the arpeggios and you learn the chords that go with them, you could start jumping them around, creating chord progressions. You could start hearing songs that you love and say, oh man, I always wanted to learn that. Oh, wait a minute, I'm hearing that now. That's a 1-6-2-5. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So that means it's like Ionian, Aeolian, Dorian, Mixolydian. So I can use those scales to navigate that bass line. You know, so once you reach a certain tipping point with that, you start seeing how things work. And it for me, that was like one of the biggest paradigm shifts, eureka moments in my whole musical life. Like, I learned the modes, I sat on them for a while, and I was like, great, I know them. Why did I learn them? Why do I know this? You know, why did I spend so much time? But then really it got to a point of me trying to use them where I was like, oh, this is like everything.
And but
it's a lot of it. It's a whole lot of it.
It's a lot.
It's a great place to build. So even if you start stepping outside a key and everything, like if you're learning even a Bach cello suite or something like that, there's a lot of moments where he's changing keys and he's using these little, you know, little moments that you're like, huh, that's a weird note choice. But you can look at those as like shifts, like portals into a new key and then shifting back, and then it's modal for a while, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, so theory is, it is an important, I do study it, and I have studied it, you know, grow after a point, after I stopped being a petulant know-it-all child, which I was for many, many years. It's very helpful to at least have like a basic understanding. And, you know, I also should say that I think it depends on just what you want to do in your musical life. I have one student who, I've been teaching him for like 14 years now or something. And he started because he wanted to learn Rush covers, and he still just wants to learn Rush covers.
So
our lessons are us just hanging out and, you know, catching up, making jokes, and then we learn a Rush song. And that's what he wants out of it. You know, like he
I love that so much.
Yeah. And like, you know, he knows his modes. He knows, you know, like, I definitely taught him some basic stuff. But if your connection to music is more casual, and that's just kind of like, you just want to do that, there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to go to Berkeley, and if you want to do all these other things, then you'd have to, you know, you have to know your stuff in that regard. Yeah. So, you know, it really just depends.
Yeah. I remember you saying when you were gigging with your dad, you kind of learned to rely on your ear a lot. Was it, when you started learning theory, was it easier for you to hear the modes or hear what was going on before understanding what it was? Because I've spoken to a lot of people that say, I don't know what this scale or mode is called, but I know that it works. Was that something that you experienced?
Yeah, and it's kind of cool seeing it, like watching other people experience it too. This is the way I did, because, you know, like when you learn a mode right out the gate, like if you're learning the Dorian scale, for example, you're like, I don't understand, like, what's the practical value of this? And then you start playing funk, and you start seeing all these, you know, root to octave to minor seventh to major sixth moves, and you're like, and then a minor third gets thrown in there, and you're like, oh, so wait a minute, Dorian could be, like, super funky. Oh, I'm hearing it now. Oh, now I get it. Okay. You know? you know, like Lydian is the Simpsons theme. You know, things like that. You start hearing them in different things, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's really pretty cool. I get it now. But, yeah, when you first are learning them, you don't see the you don't see the connection. You have to get your hands dirty with them before you start really seeing what they're about. It gets activated after a point, I find. But, yeah, there's a little bit of a lag, I think. So even if, like, you're learning, maybe you created a baseline that happened to be in Dorian, and then you play a Dorian scale, you might not hear it right off the bat.
No.
You might not. It depends on, you know, all sorts of factors. But the more you play with it, the more you'll start making those connections.
So you use quite innovative bass techniques in your playing, like two-handed slapping. What's different about the way that you approach your bass practice to be able to have that sort of freedom in your playing?
Oh, man. So there's a lot. There's a lot that has gone into my tapping practice. So I have like scale based, tapping exercises, you know, just, you know, running your scales up and back, running them in two octaves, scale pattern exercises, interval exercises, stuff like that. And then I have arpeggio exercises that, you know, ones that kind of make sense for the bass. Like if you take like the root, the fifth, the octave, and the third. I've done some Instagram reels, lesson videos on these sorts of things. And I'll bring everything up modally. I know I keep talking about them. I bring them all up and up and back. And that way, you know, you have the lay of the land and you can, you know, start experimenting. And a big part of my practice too is kind of setting my own parameters to improvise within. So once I get an exercise down, right afterwards, I say, okay, let's say I put it in five and I'll use these chords as like a chord progression. Let me see what I can create with it. And I'll say, okay, you know, maybe something cool came of it, maybe not. And then I'll pick another groove, another time signature, another key, and then just kind of poke around, see what the, you know, see what it's about. Because sometimes we learn exercises and then we're like, okay, I got it. Now what? Go to the next thing, you know?
And so yeah.
This process of getting your hands dirty with it, and I call it testing the waters. You know, I'll do it with myself. I teach it as well. You take a concept and you poke around creatively and you see if it brings you anywhere. And if it doesn't, that's cool. That's why you're just testing. You're just seeing. Because if you know, the worst thing we could do in the creative realm is force an idea. So
yeah,
this is like a workaround for that. It's just like press a little bit, see if it goes anywhere. If not, cool. Look over here. Try something else.
Yeah, I've talked to quite a few people who, in the beginning, are quite scared of improvising. What they're scared of is doing something that doesn't sound good, so they just won't. They won't try, especially in the beginning. Obviously, when you're new to the instrument, like you want to be doing things right and you want to sound good. They then won't improvise and then won't, you know, just do their own thing on the instrument because they're so intimidated by sounding bad and so scared of sounding bad.
Yeah.
But there's so much good that can come from that. And I've had to explain to people that in the past. I'm a little bit of a hypocrite because I don't do it in the same amount. I probably should do it more. I will say that. But I know in my head the extreme benefits of, you know, combining both theory and improvisation. But I also am an advocate for just play. Play and have fun and see what comes out. If it's bad, it's bad, like you said. Doesn't matter. We move on.
Yeah, and that's how we learn, is, you know, we make millions and billions of mistakes and do things that sound terribly. I've been playing bass 25-26 years and I still will have moments like that. I'll have moments like that in front of people, you know, and live, you know, solo sets, I'll make terrible mistakes. You know, it's just it's fine, you know.
Do you think that they notice that when you're playing live and you make a mistake? Do you think they notice, or is it something that you're more conscious of?
So, you know, it really depends on the audience, because in all the projects that I'm a part of, you know, it attracts, you know, nerdy musicians like me. So they're a little bit more prone to hear those things when they happen. But I will say that I've gotten pretty good at, over the years, at, you know, when something like that happens, using it and trying to do something with it. Or if it happens to be a train wreck, you know, you just laugh it off, because it's, you know, it's part of the experience. I'm a big fan of, like, you know, just when you're performing, you're trying to just give the audience like a little snippet of who you are. And who I am is a dude who makes mistakes. I do it. I know, like, it's even when I'm recording, there'll be, you know, I'll leave mistakes in my some of my solo pieces and stuff like that, and Consider the Source will do it, and any other anything else that I'm a part of, you know, within reason, unless it's like, unless you really like lose the message of what the piece is by a certain mistake, I'll leave the blemishes in there, because that's what we are. We strive, we do our best, we sculpt and go through the heartache, and then we triumph and all that. And then, you know, at the end of the day, we're still not perfect. It's cool. That's just what it is. It's we're humans.
Yeah, it's so cool that you do that, and it does. It reflects a humanness, and it's normal. And we forget that, because now, obviously, with the age of social media, you have the tools to be able to record 20,000 takes. 20,000 is a big number. That's quite an exaggeration, but like, you can record all these takes and edit things to make everything seem perfect, and like, oh, you know, people watch your video and think, oh, they got that down like first take, that's crazy, when behind the scenes it's like
I was gonna say, one of the things I appreciate about your page is that you'll post videos where you're like, yeah, you'll bleep out your curses, and you'll you know, like you make mistakes, and you show everyone that, like, yeah, you're just, you know, it's funny, like, you know, like the videos are funny when you do it, but it's also like, you know, this is the process. The process is you're trying something out and you make a mistake, and then you know, you try it again, you try to get it better. And I'll do the same thing in some of my videos. You know, I'll just leave a mistake in the reel, or I've done whole videos that are just based on like, or stories, I should say. Yeah, that's just like, you know, this is me messing up, or this is, you know, Emily telling me I'm playing too fast. Or, I mean, she's great, because she really does, like, she really does keep me on my toes. Like, it's funny, but
that was a sweet moment.
Yeah, I'm always like showing her. I mean, the poor girl, she hears like hours and hours straight of me like editing a drum part for something I'm working on, or working on one bass line and cursing and you know, damn it, don't have it yet, this and that, and she's just going about her day, very patient. It sounds good, baby.
Oh, yeah. Bless her. No, I do think it is important to show those things. It's a way of like combating the perfectionism that comes with, that's not me hating on people that don't share like their mistakes or outtakes, like, you're not obligated to share those things, but it does help other people realize, oh, okay, I'm not alone. It's not bad that it took me 12 takes to get this. Like, it just happens. Like, does it mean you're a bad player?
Yeah, and also, I think it falls under the umbrella of just the whole perceptual issue that we have on social media, where we think things are a certain way. Mm-hmm. Like, we see a person do something crazy on an instrument, and we're like, oh, man, they're just doing that all day, just like that. I'll never get to that place. Man, it's like, you know, for some people they might be inspired, but some people might be highly discouraged by that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there's also like, you know, like I'll go on vacation and bring my bass with me, and I bring like a practice amp, and I'll make videos wherever I am. And you know, like, you know, I'm making a living doing music, but I'm not rich. I'm not like, you know, whatever. And I had a student one day who, came to the lesson. And he was like, man, you know, what I want is, like, I want what you have. I want to like, be all over the place and doing this and this and that. And he started painting a picture that wasn't accurate, that I felt wasn't accurate about what my day-to-day life was. And I was like, let me stop you for a second and just let you know, like, you know, like, and I got, like, a little bit into, like, what my day-to-day life is. I'm like, I'm happy. Like, things are good. But, you know, you know, like, when you see a video of me in, like, Costa Rica, like, I worked my ass off for, like, all year to pay for that trip, and now I'm there. And my girlfriend and I are, like, hanging out and you know, being a little bit more, like, off the grid for a little bit. But don't get me wrong, like, we have to play for the right reasons, and we have to understand that what we're what you're seeing online is, you know, like, you're filling in the blanks for the people that you're watching. So you have to just, you know, just be very conscious of that sort of thing.
Yeah, you do. And I bet it was a weird experience for you having someone relay what they see your life to be, and it really not. Like, I'm thinking, what message am I putting out there? What blanks are other people filling in? What do they, you know, think my day-to-day life is? Because it probably most likely isn't what they think it is. That's so crazy. Like, if someone was to say, oh, you do this every day because I've seen this on your Instagram, I'm like, nope. That's not true. It's not. Yeah. It's not the reality. That is insane that someone's actually like filled in those blanks for you. And
yeah. It's interesting. Well, you know, it's where there's a lot of cool things about social media. There's a lot. You know, we can learn from so many people. We can watch these videos of people doing amazing things and be inspired. And you know, we have all this. I mean, just like, you know, YouTube for years, but now with Instagram, it's really cool that you can really, in like a bite-sized little way, get a little piece of information that you might be able to work on that day. And that's really cool. So, and that's the positive side of it. But, you know, that the negative side of it is I guess it's just what people sometimes make it, you know, and we have to just be careful of that element of it.
We do, yeah. Even me, who tries to have a very healthy relationship with social media, and when I'm on it, I have to remind myself that, of course, not everything I see is like the full truth. There's a lot of work that goes behind certain things and things that you don't see. But even me being conscious of that, I do sometimes slip into the negative headspaces. Like, you know, I'm not completely, you know, in the right headspace all the time. And sometimes it is social media that kind of tips that negative headspace for me. So even being conscious of it sometimes isn't enough, and it does happen. Like it does, but
yeah,
I come back to it in the end. I'm like, Layla, this is ridiculous. Like,
yeah,
put your phone down.
Yeah, go outside.
literally go outside. This is why also with your content and with your girlfriend Emily, I love the fact that you're, you know, playing outside all the time, that she'll be like working on balancing and writing poetry, and you'll be there doing your thing, tapping or whatever it is you're working on that day. That's one thing that I think is so cool about the content that you do. Because, I mean, I don't live in a very aesthetic outdoor place, but the outdoors is the outdoors. And I do know that if I'm out there just going for a walk, doing something, that, like, life is just so much better. Like, I have a way better perspective on life. But I also, I think it's really cool about where you are and the places that you go and where you choose to practice with Emily is... I just think it's really cool. Do you choose to do that because it's a nicer environment for you and it's something that helps you mentally just be good?
Yeah. It really does. It really helps recalibrate. And for me, I'm a hermit by nature. Like, if she didn't make me go outside, I wouldn't. I teach my lessons all day and I'm sitting right here and I'm doing that. And aside from, like, you know, like maybe in the morning going to the gym or something, and then I'm like in the car and then in the gym, I'm not really outside. I would stay inside for like days on end and just do music stuff. And it's, you know, it's cool in a way, but it's also like, you know, you'll especially during like the pandemic, like I would be inside for like 2 days straight or something, and like not even realize it, you know, just working on music, you know, recording stuff or whatever. So, but the other side of that is when I am outside, I'm like, why wasn't I just out here this whole time doing this? Like, as long as it's nice out, it's so much more inspiring. You're breathing actual air. It really does reset your mind. Like going for a walk, going, you know, especially if you have like any water by you, walking by the water. And, you know, and it's, I remember reading something a long time ago about like successful artists, the writers and musicians, and like habits that they had, and almost every single one of them went for walks like several times a day. Like it was just like a thing, like they, or at least like one long walk in the morning, you know. And it really, you know, it's like if we're not in the habit of doing it, we don't really see the benefits, and then when we start doing it, there's something, I mean, just being outside is pleasant, but there's also something symbolic about it, you know, like I guess in the same way you have like the ritual of drinking coffee in the morning if you're a coffee drinker. You know, it's like, you know, you the whole process is almost like ritualistic, like you're excited about it. You smell the coffee, right? You take your first sip. Oh, that's so good. the same thing with going for walks. You can go for a walk and you're like, okay, this is my time to put everything aside. I'll leave my phone, or if I bring it, I'm not looking at it. You know, we have like a lot of nice birds around here. We have ponds, we have trees, all this stuff to look at and just disconnect for at least an hour, you know, every now and then.
Yeah.
And the practicing outside too is just, that's something I did actually, growing up. My dad used to do it. He would go sit down in our, we grew up in Queens, New York. So it was like very, apartments everywhere. You know, there wasn't that much, you know, nature wise. But he would always sit outside on the steps and practice. And I took to that when I started playing. And so, when I remind myself not to be a hermit, the first thing I do is go right outside and practice there.
Yeah.
Very, very inspiring. Different headspace completely.
Yeah. It's so cool. Even you saying that you're a hermit most of the time and that like in lockdown you spent days and didn't even realize it. I'm the exact same. I could be in the house for days on end and not really, like, it's not really an issue for me. I'm not someone that feels an urge to have to be outside all the time. But when I am, exactly how you said, like, it is, you know, I realize why aren't I doing this more? This is actually very fun and refreshing. But then it goes back to the perceptual issue we were just talking about, because I, with your content watching it, I then just filled in the blanks in my head and assumed that, you know, I mean, obviously this isn't very rational because of course you'd have other things to do, but I'm like, oh, John is, you know, spending a lot of his time outside and, you know, is practicing, and all the time's a bit excessive, but like many hours of the day outside. That's like literally just, I've just realized I've filled in the blanks to your life, and then you now just told me actually I'm a hermit that teaches people lessons all day and my girlfriend has to force me to go outside.
That is more of the reality of it. I do force myself to go out more now that, you know, with her influence, but even right before this, the podcast, I had to say, okay, John, open up the window. It's right next to you. Just open up the window and get some fresh air, because you know, otherwise you'll just be like, you know, like stuffy, and you'll start getting hot in the apartment, and then you won't do anything about it because that's the way you are. So, yeah, I have to do. I have a term called John proofing. I have to John proof my life.
I love that. That's so funny. My term is Layla logic, which is...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because I'm also like, things like you said, like opening a window, if I'm hot, I just won't do it. Or this is really silly, but like when I need to go to the toilet, I'll procrastinate. Yeah. And I don't know what the Layla logic is behind that, but like to me, getting up to go to the toilet is just something that, although I need it, I'll procrastinate. Like, it's just a bit...
Well, especially if you're doing something else and you're like fixated on whatever that thing is, it's like you can't be bothered by that.
Yeah.
you just want to do the thing that you're doing, and everything else is just an annoyance.
It's
silly, but that's I think, you know, we get locked into that kind of thing. Like I'll do the same thing. I'll be working on like a song, like in Logic, and I'll be starving, and I've been starving for hours, and all I need to do is. The kitchen's right there. Just go right there and eat. Take two bites of something, and then I'll be fine. And I won't do it. I'll start getting a headache. Oh, what's wrong? Oh, you haven't had any water in like 5 hours. Oh, anyway, I'm just going to keep on blasting this loud music at myself, even though I haven't, and I could just go and get a glass of water. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I need to be safe from myself.
No, I'm the same, though. Like, actually, I've learned a bit better now. I get really hangry, and I can't not. I've learned a bit of my lesson here, and I know say if I'm trying to record a cover, I know that it's probably not going well for me because I've decided not to eat. So I will have to consciously take a break and say, Layla, if you just eat something, this experience will be so much more pleasant than it is right now. So take a break, stop this Layla logic that's going on, and eat something, and then carry on.
We have to learn what our things are, and work around them. John proofing is a funny term that I came up with to combat the things that I just know I'll do. Like I'm forgetful. I'm very, very forgetful. So as soon as I like book a student with a lesson or something like that, I write it in the calendar immediately. If like we're doing a lesson currently, it's the end of the lesson, and I say, okay, next week, Tuesday at 4 o'clock, before we hang up, I don't let them hang up until I put it in the calendar.
You've put it down.
Yeah. It's an order of operations thing. Like, if I hang up first, I just won't do it, and then 4 o'clock the following week will come, and I'll miss the lesson. So I won't get better. My memory won't get better. I know that. So I just have to have better habits to combat the things, you know, the issues that I have.
You've learned to manage it, which I feel like is all that you can do, really.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm you know, kicking and screaming. I've gotten to a point where I can manage.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah, it's like cheat codes. I'm like, I know I'll be fine if I just do this.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So your playing incorporates a large range of genres and takes inspiration from world music, like Indian rhythms, for example. Who are your biggest inspirations, and where did your interest in those come from?
So I got really more into it when the band started, when Consider the Source started. Our drummer and our guitarist were, they kind of bonded over their interest of it.
Yeah.
And they actually went to India together and studied. And so, you know, they were showing me some stuff, and I started getting into it. And then I realized that a bass player that I always loved from, I mentioned him earlier on, his name is Jonas Hellborg.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great, great, great bass player, very unique. I was into him when I was a kid because his slap bass technique was phenomenal. Really, very, very cool. No one was really quite doing it like him. And then I started noticing that he was doing kind of an Indian fusion thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already, like, you know, as a kid trying to replicate his sound, you know, and I was really just so inspired by him. And then I saw that and I was like, oh man, let me see what this is all about. So I started listening more to his Indian fusion stuff, which is so cool. It's like him and this guitarist, Sean Lane, who sadly passed away many years ago. Unbelievable. Like one of the most emotionally potent shredder guitarists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it really had something to say. It was very, very cool. And then these three Indian musicians, two percussionists and a vocalist. And I just became obsessed with this project. I was just listened to all their albums. They have a really cool DVD at the time. It was called Paris, like the Paris concert. It's on YouTube. It's really, really amazing. And then I started, just on my own, kind of studying Indian music, you know, buying books on it when they were around. I started taking lessons with this guy named Ganesh Kumar. He plays kanjira, which is sort of like it looks like a tambourine.
Yeah.
But you could bend the pitch. It has, like, just one little, like, tiny cymbal on it. And such a cool-sounding instrument. And when you see someone really rock it, it's like they're playing a whole drum set. It really sounds like that. You mic it a certain way. Such a cool instrument. And I started seeing how it worked so well with slap bass. Like when you heard kanjira next to just the technique, the slap bass technique, it just sounded so cool. So it worked so well together. So I started just diving crazily into Indian rhythms and trying to incorporate them into my slap bass technique.
Mm-hmm.
And it honestly was one of the main things another, you know, huge paradigm shift in my playing was just like seeing how they break down these large, complex rhythms into just twos and threes, like smaller numbers that they use to just create these really large, elaborate, beautifully constructed rhythms. And, you know, some of them are like, they're like playing a math problem, you know, like you have to have every to the 16th note, everything has to be dialed in perfectly in order for it to like land back on the downbeat. And what that does to your sense of rhythm, unbelievable. So cool. So anyway, I got really, really, really into that. And then it started over time, whether I realized it or not, it just started seeping into the way I just was rhythmically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even when it stopped sounding like Indian music and it started just being this tool that I could utilize to write more complex stuff. So I use it with my slap bass and all the different, rhythms that I gravitated to with that technique. I transferred it to tapping. And then all of a sudden, like, these ways of stacking twos and threes and these cool, interesting grooves that I became really comfortable with, it was like, okay, let's just see how they can exist in this technique and in this realm. And the cool thing is, from studying Indian music, a big part of it is, actually I did a reel on this recently, on conical, which is voice percussion. Mm-hmm. So if you start speaking these rhythms, it's that idea of, like, if you could speak it, you can play it. You start speaking the rhythms first, your body starts understanding them, and then you put your technique, you mix your technique with that, and there you go. You have something really cool and more rhythmically nuanced than you might have had if you worked on it some other way. So, I love listening to Indian music, and going to a classical Indian music concert is like one of the most unbelievably beautiful experiences you can have, mm-hmm. In the musical world. But also the other side of it is what you derive from learning it is immense.
Yeah, I feel like I need to dive into that. You've sold me the whole, and it makes a lot of sense, the things that you're open to now rhythmically. Like you said, like you utilize what you've learned. It doesn't necessarily sound like it's taken from Indian music, but it's given you a whole new outlook on rhythm. I think I need to... I'm going to go look back at all of your reels and do some researching, because that's definitely something that I feel like I need to get on.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's a book called, it's a really silly title, You Could Taka Dimi This. Taka Dimi is like the verbal, whatever.
I'm writing that down.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because it's like you laugh at it and you're like, okay, no one gets this. But if you get it, it's still kind of like lame, but lame funny.
That's my favorite type of funny.
Me too. Yeah. I feel like I know the guy who made it, even though I've never met him. But yeah, it's a really great book. He did a really good job putting it together, and wealth of knowledge on how you can start incorporating it into your day to day just musical life, even if you're not going to do anything really Indian music related, just the concepts of it. He lays it out really well.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a look into that, and that's a great name. I love that.
Yeah.
You obviously mentioned that you spend a lot of time teaching students, and I know you've done it for a long time because you said you had a student for over 10 years. How has teaching affected your growth as a musician? Is there anything that you felt like that you had to improve on to be a better teacher or instructor? Because it's not easy. Not everyone's equipped to teaching people. What was that like for you?
Yeah, well, I grew up, growing up around music, my dad teaches as well. So, as a kid, I'd be like 4 or 5 years old, come out of my room, my dad's teaching a lesson in the living room. So it was a natural thing for me to try to get into after a point. And I always have really enjoyed it. I love seeing my students progress. And the advantages of it for me, on top of just that element of it, is, seeing the meaning that other people derive out of learning more and getting better, is if someone asks me a question about, how do you do that thing on whatever song, I might like have to reroute and say, I don't know. Let me look at it for a second. Let me like relearn the part, and, or if I have to, sometimes I do, and say, yeah, what am I doing here? What's the implied harmony? Like, what am I like? What chord does this belong to? What key is this in? What time signature is it in? And sometimes, it makes me look back and reflect on my own stuff and see what it's about. And other times it's even simpler things. Like basic theory questions, someone will ask me, and all of a sudden in answering it and trying to be thoughtful about it, it just helped me dig deeper into some basic, ideas mm-hmm. that maybe I overlooked or never really put the things together. Yeah, you learn so much from teaching, because you have to be on your A game. You have to be.
You do. Yeah.
Yeah. Someone is putting their, paying you money and hoping that you'll be able to guide them. So you don't, you want to really you know, make sure that you're answering in a way that's honest and thoughtful and accurate, ultimately.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes you really look closer at things, which is, you know, something I think we need to do in general, just in our musical life, you know, look closely at, you know, not just the theory realm, but just in any part of it. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we, you know, why are we playing this note? Why did we play that note? Was that, you know, an ego move? Was that a spiritual move? You know, what's going on? So, yeah.
Did you feel any, I know you said that obviously you have to be thoughtful about your answers because obviously you're teaching somebody. Do you, and have you at a point felt really pressured because of that? Was teaching ever something that you were like, oh, there's a lot of pressure here? Or was it just something you were just like?
Yeah, well, so sometimes, although I think at this point, I kind of teach the way I teach, and I have my strengths and I have my weaknesses, and I'm very honest with my students about what those are.
Yeah.
You know, so like reading, I could teach someone to read, but I'm not great at it, you know? So if someone is coming to me and they want to learn to sight read, I say, look, like, if there's other things that you want to learn, you know, from me, I will teach you those things, but I can teach you how to read. I can't teach you how to get that good at reading. Like, let me, you know, I've definitely had some students that wanted to learn a certain thing. And there's other players that I've, like, even other guys on Instagram that I either know or just know through Instagram, will say, you know, who you really want to study with is this dude or this person, you know, like they're really good at that thing. It's not my strength. So because I kind of take that approach right out the gate, I feel more comfortable that it's in my wheelhouse of knowledge to teach whoever I'm teaching what they want to learn. So instead of being like feeling the pressure, I'd rather just make sure that they're set in a direction that's going to get them where they want to go. I have one student who's studying some things from me and some things from another guy who's, you know, like a really killer finger style jazz player. And I'm not that, you know, like my finger style is like pretty good, but it's like, I use it more for like, you know, rock and progressive rock kind of stuff and other weird, I don't know what to call them things. You know? So, you know, it's, yeah. And that way I kind of feel like I'm helping out the community a little bit more too, you know, giving some lessons to some people who I think are more, you know, fit the bill a little bit more.
Yeah, I asked David the same question, actually, and we kind of said the same thing as thing of, you know, it's all about being honest about who you are as a player and the things that you're good at and not good at. And then being open and honest with your students, then there's room for pressure, of course, but like there's a lot less room for it because you are being very open and honest about your capabilities, your interests and what they can learn from you. Yeah, I completely agree. Me and David did speak about that. Many musicians struggle with self-confidence and imposter syndrome. Do you recall any moments where, is this something that you deal with frequently or have dealt with at a point in your career?
Yeah, you know, I guess I'd have to analyze myself more to see if I'd call it, you know, what would be considered imposter syndrome. But I've certainly had... you know, moments of being really, you know, depressed or really bummed out over, you know, certain elements, like the trajectory of my career at certain parts of my life.
Yeah.
Or wasn't happy with where I was as a player and things like that. And now, you know, there's still traces of it, but I try to relate to those things a lot differently. You know, I try to look at those things as like messages of saying something needs to change. And I feel like we become a lot more malleable when we try to apply creativity to even our own mental stuff, you know, and how we handle those moments. So, like I have so imposter syndrome. I feel like that term it became more popular in the last couple of years, where I've been hearing it more. I had even a student recently tell me that it's been like a problem for him for a long time, and. Where I do see, I mean, you know, I was a psych major. I do see the value in labeling certain mental and emotional mechanisms that we tend to get. I feel like sometimes when we hear terms like that and we identify with them, it's almost like, right, as soon as we have that moment, we start saying, I'm a person with imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, and where there is a good part of that where we can call it something and then maybe through diagnosing it, do something about it. On the other hand, if we're not careful, it might take us over. And we might say like, oh, well, I guess that's just this thing I have. Let me, you know, I don't really know what to do about it. I guess that's just, it's me. And I think if instead we sort of look at it as like something that's, our personalities are malleable. Mm-hmm. They can be, you know, we have more sway over them than we realize. Then we can look at why we feel like we have that thing. Why do we feel like we have imposter syndrome? Is it, real? Like, are we just phoning it in? or am I just kind of feeling bad about myself for some other reasons, you know?
Yeah.
And in that process, you know, we can start getting to the bottom of more of like who we are. And that has a one-to-one relationship with our playing, you know? And I think also, in that same thought, our playing, I don't know if this has happened with you, if you've been sitting and just like practicing for like a long stint, you know, like at some point, like if you're like an hour or two into playing, you start, like your brain starts figuring out other life things at the same time. Almost because I look at it like, because when you're practicing, it's like meditating. Mm-hmm. It can be, right? It's, you're focused on one thing. But sometimes our brain goes some other places, but it stills the water because we're focused on a given thing. And sometimes we start figuring out some just other life stuff while we're in that place. And sometimes we don't realize we are, but connections that we make in that realm is like a microcosm of other stuff in our life in general. And I don't know how I got there, but I don't know how I got this. But if you haven't noticed, I like to go on tangents. But I think there's something really cool about that, and that could be sort of, I don't know, a combat to some of the, you know, some of the more negative headspaces we can get into sometimes when we're playing.
Yeah. No, I think for me, the imposter syndrome feeling just comes from an overall lack of confidence in not just my playing at times, but I think my expression just as a person. And knowing that means that I'm aware of the stuff that I need to, you know, be working on. I do agree. I think diagnosing it sometimes as imposter syndrome, a lot of the times I don't think it is that. I just know with me that those imposter syndrome-like feelings come from an overall lack of confidence, which I'm very much aware of and still are working on, but it takes time. I don't know if that's relatable to other people who have those feelings. But I think in a way it is rooted in, you know, having not much belief in yourself and your abilities and not realizing that you're capable of so much more than your brain likes to tell you. And I have to tell myself that all the time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a thing I've struggled with, on and off. I mean, as I said, I stopped playing for a while because I was like, I related to things in a very unhealthy way. The beautiful part of having music in your life consistently is that not only in the expression of it, but in the practice of it, we can work through a lot of these things. You know, it really is an amazingly healing way to spend your life. It's really, I've had so many instances of getting over things, you know, because of it. And, like, as I said, the practice of it too, you start seeing your own tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you're like, what one thing I used to do is I would have my practice routine written out, and then I'd have a practice journal. So once I was done with my practicing for the day, I'd write in the journal. I'd say, okay, how'd you do? So I started playing at noon and I did my warm-ups, and then I went into my scale exercises, and then I was hungry, And then I made a sandwich, and then I sat down in front of the TV, and I watched my favorite show. And so 45 minutes later, I got back to practicing, you know? And then you start noticing just what your tendencies are. And sometimes it's like, it wasn't just that I was hungry, it was that I was anxious. Is that I was practicing, and I wasn't doing so well, and I needed instant gratification. I needed like a dopamine boost for a second, because I was feeling bummed out that I wasn't getting this thing down. So you start learning about yourself, if you're really looking closely in those moments. And then you could say, oh, okay, so I do that. Next time I practice, I have this all written down. I'm going to force myself to play a little bit longer, even if it's uncomfortable. And I'm going to see if I end up, you know, getting more out of it and feeling better from the practice session afterwards. And sure enough, you will. You know, it's the sort of thing where you can really use it to get into a better place just in your life in general.
Yeah.
It's very cool. It's like this self feeding kind of ecosystem.
Where did you get that base journal idea from? Because I'm going to steal that. I've not heard anyone use that before. I think that's a really cool idea.
It's all yours. And I don't know. I don't know where I got it from. You know, it might have just been that I was just maybe journaling in general at the time and like, you know, I could get kind of obsessive when I'm you know, and working on certain projects. And at the time I started doing that, I was working on, I don't even remember. It might have even been like the Indian rhythmic stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was so obsessed with getting better at these things that I was like, anything I could do to hold myself accountable, I'm going to do. And the idea that I came up with was having the journal as opposed to just the practice routine. So it helps so much. I have to get back to doing it. Lately, I haven't had the best practice routine just because I'm so busy with, you know, the teaching and with touring and everything. So my playing is more maintenance than it is progress, so I haven't had as much of a need to do the journal thing these days. But in my earlier years, it's so helpful, unbelievably helpful. And you have to be honest with yourself. You have to be like, this is exactly what I did, and these are the reasons I did them. If you were really hungry, then good, write that down. Okay, let yourself off the hook. You have to eat.
You have your
hangry issue, so you have to make sure you don't go to that.
I do have my hangry issue. Yeah. I have people in my life that can testify to that. I do have a hangry issue. No, I'm going to use that. I think a lot of people have accountability issues, and I also do. That is something that I struggle with as well. I can see. I've never done the base journaling before, or journaling in general, really. I think I tried it for a period. But even just hearing you talking about it, I can already see the benefits that would come with it. And I also appreciate you saying that sometimes you have to sit through it, even if it is uncomfortable, because it is true. We don't always want to practice all the time. But then again, but then, like you said, right now for you, it's just been maintenance, and that's okay too. Not neglecting it completely. I think that's really going to help me, actually. I am going to use that. So how do you work through creative blocks? Do you experience them often? Is the journal something that you use for that, or?
Yeah, well, in a roundabout way, you know, like without formally journaling the way I used to, the benefit that you get from journaling is self-reflection, you know, and you get to, like, you know, learn yourself. It's like you're talking to yourself, but you have the time to put things more eloquently and find the right words and everything. So, you know, creative blocks for me at this point, they don't happen as much, but part of that is because I've kind of rebranded it to mean something else, to be something else, you know?
Yeah,
because if you look at it as that, you know, you can get really frustrated. And when you have frustration, you have tension, and that's the creativity killer. So what I do is, actually, I kind of mentioned it before, the testing the waters approach, where, you know, this is how I approach it myself. I'll sit down with a certain shape, you know, like an exercise or a shape that I just found, or chord that I just found, or a certain voicing of it. And I'll just see where it goes.
Mm.
And if it doesn't want to go anywhere, I don't get frustrated. I just say, okay, cool. All right, let me try something else. Maybe something else is ready to something else is ripe, you know, and ready to get a little bit. Yeah. No, but that's, you have to have sort of like a a hands-off approach with it, because otherwise, you know, like you have to push a little bit and you have to try, but you know, if you bend it till it breaks, then you're just running into a wall constantly, constantly, constantly. And I spent many years very frustrated. I would work on technique and not work on creativity. So my technique was like better than, it, you know, me 10 years ago can do things, can, you know, that me now can't do, because I was very, very, very obsessively working on certain things. But then I got to a point where it's like, that's silly. Like, why do I need to do all those things? They're not helping me. Let me foster the creative side more and learn more about, you know, that and how to bring that out more. So I got to a point where, I started to develop this way of going about it, where it was like, I have all these songs. I have a list of songs that I'm like, that's currently in my rotation that I'm, you know, developing. I have other ones. Like if I have a solo gig, I have a list of all my songs, and I say, okay, haven't played that one in a while. How the hell do I play that one again? All right, let me see. And so I'll go over them and brush up on them. And then for the ones that, you know, sometimes old songs, I want to, you know, revamp them a little bit, or if there's new songs that I'm working on, whatever the case may be, I'll see if they're ready. I'll see if they want to go somewhere, because we can't always control our level of tiredness, our busyness, you know, if we're working a lot, our state of mind in any given moment. We have some sway over it, but if an idea is not there for whatever the reason is, we can't even figure out what it is. Is it possible to figure it out, you know, in a lot of the cases, we have to just say, cool, you know, I'll come back to you and we'll see. And sometimes the next day it's ready. Sometimes a year down the road it's ready. Mm. Literally sometimes 5 years down or 10 years down the road it's ready. So we have to, so if that's really the case, like I'm working on songs now for a new project that I'm developing, that I wrote this song on a Tascam recorder when I was like 21.
Wow.
You know, so this was, you know, a long, long time ago. And now it's finally coming out in a project of mine, and it's, you know, achieving its ultimate form. You know, now it's like, now it's ready to be, you know, turned into something. But anything that I had tried over the years, I tried it in Consider the Source. It didn't work there. I tried it as a solo thing. Didn't work there. So, we have to just learn to be cool with that, with the process being what it is. It's like, you know, the muse is either there or it's not. Mm. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. There's still other things to do. There's always techniques to work on. There's always, maybe if, you know, you're working on this, you really want to finish this one song, it's not ready. There's other things to do. There's other songs to work on, other, maybe a chorus of one song you can develop there, you know? So when you look at it like that, with more of a hands-off approach, the silver lining is that you end up being more creative, and your ideas end up flowing better because you've learned to not put pressure on it. But even still, you know, the balance of it is, if we get excited about that and we know that works creatively, then we start using that as like a thing, and then all of a sudden we're back to putting pressure on it.
Yeah.
So it's like this mental emotional dance that we have to kind of have, where we just have to know that our brains are these fickle things, and we have to work with the way it is, you know, and not force it to be something that it isn't.
Yeah, and the point of there's always something else to be working on is actually a really great point, because you can get so zoned in on the one thing, maybe you're, you know, aren't feeling so creative on it or have a block on it, but like you said, there's that other thing that you could be doing. So, yeah,
always.
That's really cool.
There's always something else, yeah.
Yeah, it switched my perspective a little bit, because you can get so caught up in the moment of like, oh, I really want to get this done and this is my focus. But I'm like, if it's not working, that's fine, because you've got that to do or something else to do. Just like redirecting yourself. I don't know why I didn't have that perspective before, but it's definitely been switched.
Nice.
Yeah, so thank you for that.
Yeah, of course.
So Consider the Source was obviously a very important turning point in your life. Obviously, were the reason why, after your year and a half break, that you kind of got back into everything. I know this can be an impossible question for people, but do you have a favourite album or song off of Consider the Source. Or there could be one that emotionally ties back to a time that was super substantial to you. I don't know. Do you have a one that sticks out, or a few?
Well, I think if you ask me the same question on different days, I'd have different answers. But today I would say, as far as an album, there was one that we did. It was a triple album because we're progressive rock nerds, and that's what progressive rock nerds think is cool. We'll never do it again. The album was written during a kind of a tumultuous time in the band's career because our original drummer had left. And, you know, we were like, you know, we at the time we couldn't fathom the band without him, without any of the three of us. So it was very scary. And also during the time, me and our guitarist, Gabriel, we write all the songs, or at least write all the initial ideas before we all put our two cents in. And we were just writing and writing and writing. We had a ton of material, but then we had this big lag where we had a second drummer for like 6 months and it didn't work out. And then we have a current drummer that worked out. So time just kept going on. We kept writing new stuff, and we were already ready to record an album when he left the band. So more and more songs, more and more songs, more and more songs. And yeah, we got to a point where we're like, okay, we're going to record with our new drummer, you know, like a year or two after he joined, whatever it was. And so, yeah, we had like three albums worth of stuff. And we recorded in one studio, and then we had another guy mix it. And we just feel like the album came out sonically really beautifully.
Mm.
It was a struggle. We had like some issues, you know, during the tracking process. But the guy that did the mixing did a great job. He's a brilliant engineer. Did a great job. His name is Jocko out in, I think he lives in somewhere in Western New York. And, you know, resonates, you know, well with a bass player, someone named Jocko. So he did an exceptional job on the album, and it just sounded great. And a lot of the songs on it were like just, you know, very, very meaningful and everything. So, you know, that one, I'd say, as far as an album, as far as a song, we have a song called It Is Known, and that was on an album of ours called You Are Literally a Metaphor. And that song, for me, is one of the more meaningful ones because it was written from a very emotionally potent place. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of our songs are, you know, we try not to write cerebrally, you know, we try to write emotionally. And so this song was, without getting too heavy into it, it had to do with just the concept of death, mm-hmm. and how it, you know, it affects us all, obviously. It has to, or if it hasn't yet, it will. And so I kept thinking about it and becoming fixated on it for this particular time in my life, for whatever reason. And, you know, this melody just sort of was born from it. It was like one of the first experiences I ever had where it was like completely like out of my hands. It just like came out. And
wow.
And so, you know, wrote a chord progression with it, wrote the melody. And what we do in the band is we don't if one of us brings the initial idea in, we don't maintain ownership of it. We give it to each other to write our own parts, maybe write whole new parts. So so I wrote that initial part, and I wrote, you know, most of the other sections. Our guitarist wrote this beautiful chorus, this reharmonization of the chords underneath it. And he just plays it beautifully and takes a beautiful solo on the song. And just the whole way it came out was just really, really, I thought sonically it came out really beautifully. Everyone played really well on it. And, I was just very, very proud of it. And it's just like, for me, it was one of the most authentic, just beautiful moments writing a song and working on it with my bandmates, you know? And, you know, like Gabriel has brought in some, you know, outstanding song ideas. Like we kind of go half and half with it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that he's brought to the table too that are just like, you know, like some of the, you know, most beautiful ideas and so much fun to work on. So yeah, as I said, if you were to ask me tomorrow, I might come up with one that he brought
a
to the table.
One. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like you guys have a really nice and healthy dynamic. Like, consider the Source as a band that you work very well with each other creatively. I like that you said you don't, where if someone brings an idea to the table, that's not like ownership straight away. I think that's a really nice dynamic. Has there ever been points where it's been hard to work with, not necessarily those guys, but like other people in general? Has there been moments where it's been difficult?
Yeah, of course. You know, and you know, we've had issues in the band. Mm. You know, between the three of us, between, you know, two of us here and there, you know, in the creative process and whatever, it's a relationship. It's going to happen. Any band in history, you're going to have,
yeah,
you know, those issues. And, you know, and over time we've grown and we've changed and we're, you know, we're different people and we're different musicians. And we're very, very proud of the band and it's doing well. And it's somehow we can play this weird stuff and have a fan base and, you know, like, travel all
there's
over doing
market
it.
There's a market for it.
There is, yeah. No, we've said from the beginning, we're very, very fortunate that we can do it. But, you know, we also, one of the ways of mitigating the issues where maybe we don't see eye to eye on things is we have other projects, you know?
Yeah.
Like being able to have a solo project and have my new project, Mono Means One, where it's more of like a elaborate version of my solo project. I can explore, you know, some of the ideas exactly the way I'm kind of hearing them and just see where it goes, you know, and explore the benefits and the, you know, deficits of that. You know, like there's some times where even in my other projects, I'm like, oh, this is sounding really cool. Yeah, that's exactly how I want the drum, this and that. I'm like, man, Gabe would play that melody way better than I'm playing it right now. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's cool though that you get to, I think it's important to have other outlets, you know, after a point, especially because, you know, we have different needs, we have different, visions, and it helps all the projects kind of have a freshness to it, which in any relationship, in any way, you have to have, you know, you have to have ways of kind of recalibrating, keeping things interesting, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of like what we do here. We all just do like our own side things. We do side gigs. And yeah, it's awesome. It gives you a much fuller, more richer musical life.
Yeah. No, I love that. And you use the word relationship to describe it. And that's a great word to use because even in relationships, just in general, and we can talk about like romantic relationships, it's important to have a sense of self as well in those. So the fact that you all are also working on personal projects is very reflective of what a healthy relationship looks like. So that makes a lot of sense. It's because in an everyday normal relationship, of course, it's really important to make sure that you're still at your core an individual and have a great sense of self. So, of course, within Consider the Source, you also have these independent projects that you work on. That's so cool.
Yeah, I love that.
And relationship is like the perfect word to use there.
Yeah, yeah, it really is like that. And, you know, all parties have to be sensitive to it.
Uh-huh.
You know, like if you're going to be in, you know, unless you're like a hired gun for a specific thing and they're like, here's the bass line, play that bass line. Here's the drum part, play that drum part. You know, if I want you to do your own thing, I'll let you know, do your own thing. You know, unless it's that kind of situation, that's different. That's a different kind of transaction. That's not so much a relationship.
Yeah.
But if you're in a project where it's everyone's band, then, you know, I think that's the way to, that's the way you have to operate.
Yeah, in terms of longevity as well, maintaining the health of yourselves and the band, I think that's a very great point. I think that's the way that it kind of needs to be. So we're at the last question already. Now, this question I get a lot of different responses to it. It is a bit of a weird question, but I do like to tie to the title of the podcast. So if you were to choose a song that was essentially your soundtrack to success, what song would it be? So a song that essentially represents you or the success that you've had in your career so far, because it's not finished. You have mm-hmm. successes yet to experience. What song? It could be considered the source song. It could be a song from childhood. It could be a song of your own. I know this is a tough ask to pick one.
Yeah, it's tough, especially because most of the music that I like is instrumental.
yeah, but there's emotion in that.
Oh, of course, of course, yeah. Of course. You know what I'd have to say is, you know, since tapping is such a huge part of what I do now as a bass player, you know, once I made that shift, it became like I became pretty obsessed with it. One of the songs that really put me over to the edge to want to tap the way that I do, it was Brad Meldow's version of Paranoid Android.
Okay.
And by Radiohead, yeah. So Brad Meldow's an incredible jazz pianist, and he did a cover of, yeah, like maybe Radiohead's most famous song. Mm-hmm. And it was I love that song to death, just the original version of it, a beautiful composition. But what Brad does with the song is just like the pinnacle of like musical achievement, in my opinion. Yeah. And it's between it just emotionally being such a beautiful song and his way of exploring it just being so spot on and so explorative and just incredibly powerful. That song kind of put me over the edge, and I've listened to it 1,000 times, and it's mm-hmm. always in my head, and really kind of spurred me along. So because of not only how much I love it, but because of how meaningful it was to me and how inspired I was after I first heard it to do something else with the instrument, and how that changed literally the trajectory of my life.
Yeah, literally.
You know? Yeah. The two things being that song and the bass that I have having a high C string, and it just being mm-hmm. a great instrument by Federa, who's just the best luthiers in the world, in my opinion. Both of those things turned me into a different player.
Yeah.
I became a completely different bass player. I feel like I became more of a composer than only a bass player at that point.
No, so, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. That would be the song I would choose. Thank you. Probably choose that every day of the week.
Yeah. I was thinking maybe he'll have a different one tomorrow. But no, that was a great answer. I love that. And the whole composer changed from to composer from bass player is a really good way of saying it, because it does make a lot of sense, and that's kind of how your journey's been. I do also have to say I love the t-shirt that you're wearing.
Oh, yeah,
I've been meaning to say it for such a long time. For people who are listening, it says support your local pizza dealer.
That's right. Yeah. So this shirt was my drummer Jeff in Consider the Source. He makes these shirts. He makes different pizza related shirts because he's obsessed with pizza.
Okay.
And it's really funny. Yeah, he'll do this thing where if we go to a city and he eats a slice of pizza that's not good, it's uh-huh. almost as if he didn't eat it. He'll just go out and find a better one. or just a better meal. And he's like, oh, no, I have to get a redemption slice.
Yeah, he's not letting it ruin his day. That's why.
He's not. No. Exactly. But yeah, so he makes this shirt. So I wear it a lot. I love it. It's hysterical. I've had it for 5 years now. Yeah.
It looks brand new. That's cool. It actually looks brand new if you haven't it for 5 years.
Actually, you know what? I might have lied to you. This might be my new one. He gave me one last week. That's a new one. And I do have. Yeah, he was like, did you ask for a new one? I was like, no, but I'll take it. I'll totally take a new one. Yeah.
All the pizza shirts, I'll have all of them.
Yeah, I one of each.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, John, for taking the time to speak to me. It's been really nice.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's great talking to you.
No problem. I was going to say welcome anytime. You genuinely are welcome anytime. But I don't know what we'd speak about in the second episode. Who knows?
Yeah, some new questions.
Homeowners, if you're looking for the best in home security and smart home technology at a price you can actually afford, we have great news. Now you can get Vivint's award-winning home security systems starting at about a dollar a day. U.S. News and World Report has recognized Vivint as the best professionally installed home security system of 2022. And right now, you can get Vivint's home security technology for about a dollar a day. Plus, get free professional installation from a licensed technician. Protect your home and loved ones for as low as a dollar a day. Call right now for your free home security consultation.
800-587-4281. 800-587-4281. 800-587-4281. That's 800-587-4281. Packages start at $29.99 a month with signed agreement. Restrictions apply. Speak to a representative for complete offer details. See Vivint.com for license details. Terms and conditions apply.
In times of economic uncertainty and chaos, your money means nothing. You may not even be able to get it from your bank or ATM. And the money you do have in the stock market will go down and down. What you can bank on is gold and silver. Gold and silver have been a reliable and trusted form of currency for thousands of years. Gold and silver have never been worth zero, and typically gold holds its value during economic turmoil. Call the Gold Hotline now and learn how to protect your money and your assets with gold and silver. And learn how to set up a new IRA or roll over your current one into a gold-backed IRA. Protect your money from the next market crash with gold and silver. Call now for your free gold guide.
800-557-7921. 800-557-7921. 800-557-7921. That's 800-557-7921.
If you served in the Marine Corps, by now you know about the contaminated water problem at Camp Lejeune. If you were stationed or worked at Camp Lejeune from 1953 to 1987, you probably have a lot of questions. We have some answers. You could be entitled to compensation. Billions of dollars are being allocated to pay for damages to anyone stationed at Camp Lejeune during that time. Unfortunately, it appears that officials may have known the contaminated water problem existed and did little to protect their men. The Semper Fi Code was not honored. If you or someone in your family has developed a serious illness, including various forms of cancer, call this Camp Lejeune legal support line right now. You can't turn back the clock and change what happened, but you can certainly call right now and learn your rights as a Marine. Here's the number.
800-485-5801. 800-485-5801. 800-485-5801. That's 800-485-5801.